On the October morning that Lindbergh landed at Newark Airport, among the entourage waiting to welcome him to New Jersey was Rabbi Lionel Bengelsdorf of B'nai Moshe, the first of the city's conservative temples organized by Polish Jews. B'nai Moshe was a few blocks from the heart of the old pushcart ghetto, still the city's poorest district, though home no longer to B'nai Moshe's congregants, but to a community of impoverished Negroes, recent migrants from the South. For years, B'nai Moshe had been losing out in the competition for the well-to-do. By 1940, these families had either left conservatism and affiliated themselves to the Reform congregations, B'nai Jeshurun and Oheb Shalom, each planted impressively amid the old mansions on High Street, or joined the other long-established conservative temple, B'nai Abraham, located several miles west of where it had been originally housed in a former Baptist church and adjacent now to the homes of the Jewish doctors and lawyers living in Clinton Hill. The new B'nai Abraham was the most splendid of the city's temples, a circular building austerely designed in what was called the Greek style, and vast enough to hold 1,000 worshippers on the high holidays. Joachim Prince, an emigre expelled from Berlin by Hitler's Gestapo, had replaced the retiring Julius Silberfeld as the temple's rabbi the year before and was already emerging as a forceful man with a broad social outlook who offered his prosperous congregants a perspective on Jewish history marked strongly by his own recent experience at the bloody scene of the Nazi crime. Rabbi Bengelsdorf's sermons were broadcast weekly over station WNJR to the hoi polloi he called his radio congregation, and he was the author of several books of inspirational poetry routinely given as gifts to bar mitzvah boys and newlyweds. He'd been born in South Carolina in 1879, the son of an immigrant dry goods merchant, and whenever he addressed a Jewish audience, whether from the pulpit or over the air, his courtly southern accent, along with his sonorous cadences and the cadences of his own multisyllabic name, left an impression of dignified profundity. On the subject, for instance, of his friendship with Rabbi Silberfeld of B'nai Abraham and Rabbi Foster of B'nai Jeshurun, he once told his radio audience, "It was fated. Just as Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle belonged together in the ancient world, so we belong together in the religious world." And the homily on selflessness that he proffered to explain to radio listeners why a rabbi of his standing was content to stay on at the head of a waning congregation, he introduced by saying, "Perhaps you will be interested in my answer to questions that have been asked of me by literally thousands of people. Why do you renounce the commercial benefits of a peripatetic ministry? Why do you choose to remain in Newark, at Temple B'nai Moshe, as your only pulpit, when you have 6 opportunities every day to leave it for other congregations?" He had studied at the great institutions of learning in Europe, as well as at American universities, and was reputed to speak 10 languages, to be versed in classical philosophy, theology, art history, and ancient and modern history, to never compromise on questions of principle, to never refer to his notes at the lectern or on a lecture platform, to never be without a set of index cards pertaining to the topics most engaging him at the moment, to which he added new reflections and impressions every day. He was also an excellent equestrian, known to bring his horse to a halt so as to jot down a thought, employing his saddle as a makeshift desk. Early each morning, he exercised by riding out along the bridle paths of Wheatquake Park, accompanied, until her death from cancer in 1936, by his wife, the heiress to Newark's wealthiest jewelry manufacturer. Her family mansion on Elizabeth Avenue, where the couple had been living just across from the park since their marriage in 1907, housed a treasury of Judaica, said to be among the most valuable private collections in the world. By 1940, Lionel Bengelsdorf claimed the longest record of service at his own temple of any rabbi in America. The newspapers referred to him as the religious leader of New Jersey Jewry, and in reporting on his numerous public appearances, invariably mentioned his gift for oratory, along with the 10 languages. In 1915, at the 250th anniversary celebration of the founding of Newark, he had sat at the side of Mayor Raymond and delivered the invocation just as he delivered invocations annually at the parades for Memorial Day and the 4th of July. "Rabbi exalts Declaration of Independence" was a headline that appeared annually in the Star Ledger every July 5th. In his sermons and talks calling the development of American ideals the first priority of Jews and the Americanization of Americans the best means to preserve our democracy against Bolshevism, radicalism, and anarchism, he frequently quoted from Theodore Roosevelt's final message to the nation when the late president said, "There can be no divided allegiance here. Any man who says he's an American, but something else also, isn't an American at all. We have room, but for one flag, the American flag." Rabbi Bengelsdorf had spoken on the Americanization of Americans in every Newark church and public school, before most every fraternal, civic, historical, and cultural group in the state. And news articles in the Newark papers about his speeches were datelined with the names of scores of cities around the country to which he'd been called to address conferences and conventions on the theme, as well as on issues ranging from crime and the prison reform movement. "The prison reform movement is saturated with the highest ethical principles and religious ideals. To the causes of the world war, the war is the result of the worldly ambitions of the European peoples and their effort to reach the goals of military greatness, power, and wealth. To the importance of day nurseries, the nurseries are life gardens of human flowers in which each child is helped to grow in an atmosphere of joy and gladness. To the evils of the industrial age, we believe that the worth of the working man is not to be computed by the material value of his production. To the suffrage movement, whose proposal to extend to women the franchise to vote he strongly opposed, arguing that if men are not capable of handling the business of the state, why not help them become so? No evil has ever been cured by doubling it. My Uncle Monty, who hated all rabbis, but had an especially venomous loathing of Bengelsdorf, dating back to his childhood as a charity student in the B'nai Moshe religious school, liked to say of him, "Pompous son of a bitch knows everything. Too bad he doesn't know anything else." Rabbi Bengelsdorf's appearance at the airport, where according to the caption beneath the photograph on the front page of the Newark News, he stood first in line to shake Lindbergh's hand when he emerged from the cockpit of the Spirit of St. Louis, was a source of consternation to great numbers of the city's Jews, my parents among them, as was the quotation attributed to him in the paper's account of Lindbergh's brief visit. "I am here," Rabbi Bengelsdorf told the news, "to crush all doubt of the unadulterated loyalty of the American Jews to the United States of America. I offer my support to the candidacy of Colonel Lindbergh because the political objectives of my people are identical with his. America is our beloved homeland. America is our only homeland. Our religion is independent of any piece of land other than this great country to which, now as always, we commit our total devotion and allegiance as the proudest of citizens. I want Charles Lindbergh to be my president, not in spite of my being a Jew, but because I am a Jew, an American Jew." 3 days later, Bengelsdorf participated in the huge rally held at Madison Square Garden to mark the end of Lindbergh's flying tour. By then, the election was but 2 weeks away, and though there appeared to be growing Lindbergh support among voters throughout the traditionally Democratic South, and close contests were predicted in the most conservative Midwestern states, national polls showed the president comfortably ahead in the popular vote and well ahead in electoral votes. Republican Party leaders were reported to be in despair over their candidate's stubborn refusal to allow anyone other than himself to determine the strategy of his campaign. And so, to draw him out of the repetitious austerity of his interminable barnstorming and envelop him in an atmosphere more like that of the boisterous Philadelphia nominating convention, the Madison Square Garden rally was organized and broadcast nationwide on the evening of the second Monday in October. The 15 speakers introducing Lindbergh that night were described as prominent Americans from all walks of life. Among them was a farm leader to talk about the harm a war would do to American farming, which was in crisis still from the First World War and the Depression, a labor leader to talk about the disaster a war would represent for American workers, whose lives would be regimented by government agencies, a manufacturer to talk about the catastrophic long-term consequences for American industry of wartime overexpansion and onerous taxation, a Protestant clergyman to talk about the brutalizing effect of modern warfare on the young men who would be doing the fighting, and a Catholic priest to talk about the inevitable deterioration of the spiritual life of a peace-loving nation like our own and the destruction of decency and kindness because of the hatred bred by war. Lastly, there was a rabbi, New Jersey's Lionel Bengelsdorf, who received an especially hearty welcome from the full house of Lindbergh supporters when his turn came to take the lectern, and who was there to expatiate on how Lindbergh's association with the Nazis was anything but complicitous. "Yep," Alvin said, "they bought him. Fix is in. They slipped a gold ring through his big Jew nose, and now they can lead him anywhere." "You don't know that," my father said, but not because he wasn't himself steamed up by Bengelsdorf's behavior. "Listen to the man," he told Alvin. "Give the man a hearing. It's only fair." Words uttered largely for Sandy's benefit and mine, to keep the startling turn of events from seeming as terrible to the two of us as it did to the adults. The night before, I had fallen onto the floor in my sleep, something that hadn't happened since I'd first graduated from a crib to a bed, and to prevent me from rolling out of it, my parents had to set a pair of kitchen chairs at the side of the mattress. When it was assumed automatically that my falling like that after all these years could only have had to do with Lindbergh showing up at Newark Airport, I insisted that I didn't remember a bad dream about Lindbergh, and I just remembered waking up on the floor between my brother's bed and mine, even though I happened to know that I virtually never got to sleep any longer, without envisioning the Lindbergh drawings stashed away in my brother's portfolio. I kept wanting to ask Sandy if he couldn't hide them in our cellar storage bin instead of under the bed beside mine, but because I'd sworn not to speak about the drawings to anyone, and because I couldn't bring myself to part with my own Lindbergh stamp, I didn't dare to raise them as an issue, though they were indeed haunting me and rendering unapproachable the brother whose reassurance I'd never needed more. It was a cold evening. The heat was on and the windows were closed, but even without being able to hear them, you knew that radios were playing up and down the block and that families who wouldn't otherwise consider listening to a Lindbergh rally were tuned in because of the scheduled appearance there of Rabbi Bengelsdorf. Among his own congregants, a few important people had already begun to call for his resignation, if not for his immediate removal by the temple's board of trustees, while the majority, continuing to support him, tried to believe that their rabbi was merely exercising his democratic right of free speech and that, horrified though they were by his public endorsement of Lindbergh, to attempt to silence a conscience as renowned as his did not fall within their rights. That night, Rabbi Bengelsdorf disclosed to America what he claimed to be the true motive behind Lindbergh's personal flying missions to Germany in the 1930s. Contrary to the propaganda disseminated by his critics, the rabbi informed us, he did not once visit Germany as a sympathizer or a supporter of Hitler's, but rather he traveled each and every time as a secret advisor to the U.S. government. Far from his betraying America, as the misguided and the ill-intentioned continued to charge, Colonel Lindbergh has almost single-handedly served to strengthen America's military preparedness by imparting his knowledge to our own military and by doing everything within his power to advance the cause of American aviation and to expand America's air defenses. "Jesus," cried my father. "Everybody knows." "Shh," whispered Alvin. "Shh. Let the great orator speak." Yes, in 1936, long before the beginning of the European hostilities, the Nazis awarded Colonel Lindbergh a medal. "And yes," continued Bengelsdorf, "yes, the colonel accepted their medal. But all the while, my friends, all the while, secretly exploiting their admiration in order, better, to protect and preserve our democracy, and to preserve our neutrality through strength. "I cannot believe," my father began. "Try," muttered Alvin evilly. "This is not America's war," Bengelsdorf announced, and the crowd at Madison Square Garden responded with a full minute of applause. "This," the rabbi told them, "is Europe's war." Again, sustained applause. "It is one of a thousand-year-long sequence of European wars dating back to the time of Charlemagne. It is their second devastating war in less than half a century. And can anyone forget the tragic cost to America of their last great war? 40,000 Americans killed in action. 192,000 Americans wounded. 76,000 Americans dead of disease. 350,000 Americans on disability today because of their participation in that war. And just how astronomical will the price be this time? The number of our dead, tell me, President Roosevelt, will it be merely doubled or tripled? Or will it perhaps be quadrupled? Tell me, Mr. President, what sort of America will the massive slaughter of innocent American boys leave in its wake? Of course, the Nazi harassment and persecution of its German Jewish population is a cause of enormous anguish to me, as it is to every Jew. During the years I was studying theology with the faculties of the great German universities in Heidelberg and in Bonn, I made many distinguished friends there, great men of learning who, today simply because they are Germans of Jewish extraction, have been dismissed from long-held scholarly positions and are being ruthlessly persecuted by the Nazi hoodlums who have taken command of their homeland. I oppose their treatment with every ounce of my strength, and so too does Colonel Lindbergh oppose their treatment. But how will this cruel fate that has befallen them in their own land be alleviated by our great country going to war with their tormentors? If anything, the predicament of all of Germany's Jews would only worsen immeasurably. Worsen, I fear, tragically. Yes, I am a Jew. And as a Jew, I feel their suffering with a familial sharpness. But I am an American citizen, my friends. Again, the applause. I am an American born and raised. And so I ask you, how would my pain be lessened if America were now to enter the war and, along with the sons of our Protestant families and the sons of our Catholic families, the sons of our Jewish families, were to fight and die by the tens of thousands on a blood-soaked European battleground? How would my pain be diminished by my having to console my very own congregants? It was my mother, usually the least ardent member of our family, the one ordinarily quieting the rest of us when we turned demonstrative, who all at once found the sound of Bengelsdorf's southern accent so intolerable that she had to leave the room. But until he finished his speech and was loudly cheered off the stage by the garden audience, no one else moved or said another word. I wouldn't dare to, and my brother was preoccupied, as he often was in such a setting, with sketching what we all look like now while listening to the radio. Alvin's was the silence of murderous loathing, and my father, divested for perhaps the first time in his life of that relentless passion he brought to the struggle against setback and disappointment, was too stirred up to speak. Pandemonium, unspeakable delight. Lindbergh had at last stepped onto the garden stage, and like someone half-demented, my father leaped from the sofa and snapped off the radio just as my mother came back into the living room and asked, "Who would like something?" "Alvin," she said with tears in her eyes. "A cup of tea?" Her job was to hold our world together as calmly and as sensibly as she could. That was what gave her life fullness, and that was all she was trying to do. And yet, never had any of us seen her rendered so ridiculous by this commonplace maternal ambition. "What the hell is going on?" my father began to shout. "What the hell did he do that for? That stupid speech. Does he think that one single Jew is now going to go out and vote for this anti-Semite because of that stupid lying speech? Has he completely lost his mind? What does this man think he's doing?" "Koshering Lindbergh," Alvin said. "Koshering Lindbergh for the Goyim." "Koshering what?" my father said, exasperated with Alvin's seemingly speaking sarcastic nonsense at a moment of such confusion. "Doing what?" "They didn't get him up there to talk to Jews. They didn't buy him off for that. Don't you understand?" Alvin asked, fiery now, with what he took to be the underlying truth. "He's up there talking to the Goyim. He's giving the Goyim all over the country his personal rabbi's permission to vote for Lindy on election day. Don't you see, Uncle Herman, what they got the great Bengelsdorf to do? He just guaranteed Roosevelt's defeat." At about 2 a.m. that night, while soundly asleep, I again rolled out of my bed, but this time I remembered afterward what I'd been dreaming before I hit the floor. It was a nightmare, all right, and it was about my stamp collection. Something had happened to it. The design on two sets of my stamps had changed in a dreadful way without my knowing when or how. In the dream, I'd gotten the album out of my dresser drawer to take with me to my friend Earl's, and I was walking with it toward his house as I'd done dozens of times before. Earl Axman was 10, and in the fifth grade, he lived with his mother in the new four-story yellow brick apartment house built 3 years earlier on the large empty lot near the corner of Chancellor and Summit, diagonally across from the grade school. Before that, he lived in New York. His father was a musician with the Glenn Gray Casa Loma Orchestra, Cy Axman, who played tenor saxophone beside Glenn Gray's alto. Mr. Axman was divorced from Earl's mother, a theatrically good-looking blonde who'd briefly been a singer with the band before Earl was born and, according to my parents, was originally from Newark, and a brunette, a Jewish girl named Louise Swig, who'd gone to Southside and became famous locally in musical reviews at the YMHA. Among all the boys I knew, Earl was the only child with divorced parents and the only one whose mother wore heavy makeup and off-the-shoulder blouses and billowing ruffled skirts with a big petticoat underneath. She also made a record of the song, "You Gotta Be This or That," when she was with Glenn Gray, and Earl played it for me often. I never came upon another mother like her. Earl didn't call her Ma or Mom. He called her, scandalously, Louise. She had a closet in her bedroom full of those petticoats, and when Earl and I were alone together at his house, he'd show them to me. He even let me touch one once, whispering, while I waited to decide whether to do it, "Wherever you want." Then he opened a drawer and showed me her brassieres and offered to let me touch one of those, but that I declined. I was still young enough to admire a brassiere from afar. His parents each gave him a full dollar a week to spend on stamps, and when the Casa Loma Orchestra wasn't playing in New York and was out touring, Mr. Axman sent Earl envelopes with airmail stamps postmarked from cities everywhere. There was even one from Honolulu, Oahu, where Earl, who wasn't above cloaking his absent father in splendor, as though to the son of an insurance agent, having a saxophonist with a famous swing band for a father and a peroxide blonde singer for a mother weren't amazing enough, claimed that Mr. Axman had been taken to a private home to see the canceled 2-cent Hawaiian missionary stamp of 1851. Issued 47 full years before Hawaii was annexed to the United States as a territory, and whose central design was just the numeral 2, an unimaginable treasure valued at $100,000. Earl owned the best stamp collection around. He taught me everything practical and everything esoteric that I learned as a small kid about stamps, about their history, about collecting mint versus used, about technical matters like paper, printing, color, gum, overprints, grills, special printing, about the great forgeries and design errors, and, prodigious pedant that he was, had begun my education by telling me about the French collector Monsieur Appin, who coined the word philately, explaining its derivation from two Greek words, the second of which, atelia, meaning freedom from tax, never quite made sense to me. And whenever we'd finish up in his kitchen with our stamps and he was momentarily done with his domineering, he'd giggle and say, "Now let's do something awful," which was how I got to see his mother's underwear. In the dream, I was walking to Earl's with my stamp album clutched to my chest when someone shouted my name and began chasing me. I ducked into an alleyway and scurried back into one of the garages to hide and to check the album for stamps that might have come loose from their hinges when, while fleeing my pursuer, I stumbled and dropped the album at the very spot on the sidewalk where we regularly played I Declare War. When I opened to my 1932 Washington Bicentennials, 12 stamps, ranging in denomination from the half-cent dark brown to the 10-cent yellow, I was stunned. Washington wasn't on the stamps anymore. Unchanged at the top of each stamp, lettered in what I'd learned to recognize as white-faced Roman and spaced out on either one or two lines, was the legend, United States Postage. The colors of the stamps were unchanged as well. The 2-cent red, the 5-cent blue, the 8-cent olive green, and so on, all the stamps were the same regulation size, and the frames for the portraits remained individually designed as they were in the original set, but instead of a different portrait of Washington on each of the 12 stamps, the portraits were now the same, and no longer of Washington, but of Hitler. And on the ribbon beneath each portrait, there was no longer the name Washington either. Whether the ribbon was curved downward, as on the 1/2-cent stamp and the 6, or curved upward as on the 4, the 5, the 7, and the 10, or straight with raised ends as on the 1, the 1.5, the 2, the 3, the 8, and the 9, the name lettered across the ribbon was Hitler. It was when I looked next at the album's facing page to see what, if anything, had happened to my 1934 National Park set of 10 that I fell out of the bed and woke up on the floor, this time screaming. Yosemite in California, Grand Canyon in Arizona, Mesa Verde in Colorado, Crater Lake in Oregon, Acadia in Maine, Mount Rainier in Washington, Yellowstone in Wyoming, Zion in Utah, Glacier in Montana, the Great Smoky Mountains in Tennessee. And across the face of each, across the cliffs, the woods, the rivers, the peaks, the geyser, the gorges, the granite coastline, across the deep blue water and the high waterfalls, across everything in America that was the bluest and the greenest and the whitest and to be preserved forever in these pristine reservations, was printed a black swastika.
Chapter 2, November 1940 to June 1941. Loudmouth Jew. In June 1941, just 6 months after Lindbergh's inauguration, our family drove the 300 miles to Washington, D.C., to visit the historic sites and the famous government buildings. My mother had been saving in a Christmas Club account at the Howard Savings Bank for close to 2 years, a dollar a week out of the household budget to cover the bulk of our prospective travel expenses. The trip had been planned back when FDR was a second-term president and the Democrats controlled both houses. But now, with the Republicans in power and the new man in the White House considered a treacherous enemy, it was a brief family discussion about our driving north instead, to see Niagara Falls and to take the boat cruise in rain slickers through the St. Lawrence Seaway's Thousand Islands, and then to cross over in our car into Canada to visit Ottawa. Some among our friends and neighbors had already begun talking about leaving the country and migrating to Canada should the Lindbergh administration openly turn against the Jews. And so, a trip to Canada would also familiarize us with a potential haven from persecution. Back in February, my cousin Alvin had already left for Canada to join the Canadian Armed Forces, just as he said he would, and fight on the British side against Hitler. Till his departure, Alvin had been my family's ward for close to 7 years. His late father was my father's oldest brother. He died when Alvin was 6, and Alvin's mother, a second cousin of my mother's, and the one who'd introduced my parents to each other, died when Alvin was 13, and so he'd come to live with us during the 4 years he attended Wheatcrake High. A quick-witted boy who gambled and stole and whom my father was dedicated to saving. Alvin was 21 in 1940, renting a furnished room upstairs from a Wright Street shoeshine parlor just around the corner from the produce market, and by then working almost 2 years for Steinheim and Sons, one of the city's two biggest Jewish construction firms. The other was run by the Rackland brothers. Alvin got the job through the elder Steinheim, the founder of the company and an insurance customer of my father's. Old man Steinheim, who had a heavy accent and couldn't read English, but who was, in my father's words, made of steel, still attended high holiday services at our local synagogue. On a Yom Kippur several years back, when the old man saw my father outside the synagogue with Alvin, he mistook my cousin for my older brother and asked, "What does the boy do? Let him come over and work for us." There, Abe Steinheim, who turned his immigrant father's little building company into a multi-million-dollar operation, though only after a major family war had put his two brothers out on the street, took a liking to solid, stocky Alvin and the cocksure way he carried himself. And instead of sticking him in the mailroom or using him as an office boy, he made Alvin his driver, to run errands, to deliver messages, to whisk him back and forth to the construction sites, to check on the subcontractors, whom Abe called the chiselers. Though it was he, Alvin said, who chiseled them and took advantage of everyone. On Saturdays during the summer, Alvin drove him down to Freehold, where Abe owned half a dozen trotters that he raced at the old harness track, horses he liked to refer to as hamburgers. "We got a hamburger running today at Freehold." And down they'd shoot in the caddy to watch his horse lose every time. He never made any money at it, but that wasn't the idea. He raced horses on Saturdays for the Road Horse Association at the pretty trotting track in Wheatcrake Park, and he talked to the papers about restoring the flat track at Mount Holly, whose glory days were long past, and this was how Abe Steinheim managed to become Commissioner of Racing for the state of New Jersey and got a shield on his car that enabled him to drive up on the sidewalk and sound a siren and park anywhere. And it was how he became friendly with the Monmouth County officials and insinuated himself into the horsey set at the shore. Wall Township and Spring Lake Goyim, who would take him to their fancy clubs for lunch, where, as Abe told Alvin, "Everybody sees me and all they're doing is whispering. Can't wait to whisper. Look at what's here." But they don't mind drinking my booze and getting treated to great dinners, and so in the end, it pays off. He had his deep-sea fishing boat docked at the Shark River Inlet, and he would take them out on it and liquor them up and hire guys to catch the fish for them, so that whenever a new hotel went up anywhere from Long Branch to Point Pleasant, it was on a site the Steinheims got for next to nothing. Abe, like his father, having the great wisdom of buying things only at discount. Every 3 days, Alvin would drive him the 4 blocks from the office to 744 Broad Street for a quick trim in the lobby barbershop behind the cigar stand, where Abe Steinheim bought his Trojans and his $1.50 cigars. Now, 744 Broad was one of the two tallest office buildings in the state, where the National Newark and Essex Bank occupied the top 20 floors and the city's prestigious lawyers and financiers occupied the rest, and where New Jersey's biggest money men regularly frequented the barbershop. And yet a part of Alvin's job was to call immediately beforehand to tell the barber to get ready. Abe was coming, and whoever was in the chair to throw him out. At dinner, the night that Alvin got the job, my father told us that Abe Steinheim was the most colorful, the most exciting, the greatest builder Newark had ever seen. "And a genius," my father said. "He didn't get there without being a genius. Brilliant. And a handsome man. Blonde, husky but not fat, always looks nice, camel hair coats, black and white shoes, beautiful shirts, impeccably dressed. And a beautiful wife. Polished, classy, a Freilich by birth, a New York Freilich, a very wealthy woman in her own right. Abe, shrewd as they come, and the man has guts, Ask anybody in Newark the riskiest project, and Steinheim takes it on. He does buildings where no one else will take a chance. Alvin will learn from him. He'll watch him, and he'll see what it is to work round the clock for something that's yours. He could be an important inspiration in Alvin's life.
Largely so my father could keep tabs on him, and my mother could know that he wasn't surviving on hot dogs alone, Alvin came to our house a couple of times a week to eat a good meal. And miraculously, instead of his getting stern lectures about honesty and responsibility and hard work at the dinner table every night, as in the days after he'd been caught with his hand in the till at the Esso station where he worked after school, and until my father prevailed on Simkowitz, the owner, to drop the charges and himself made good with the money, looked to be headed for the Rahway Reformatory, Alvin conversed heatedly with my father about politics, about capitalism particularly, a system that, ever since my father had gotten him to take an interest in reading the paper and talking about the news, Alvin deplored, but that my father defended, patiently reasoning with his rehabilitated nephew, and not like a member of the National Association of Manufacturers, but as a devotee of Roosevelt's New Deal. He'd warn Alvin, "You don't have to tell Mr. Steinheim about Karl Marx, because the man won't hesitate. You'll be out on your keister. Learn from him. That's why you're there. Learn from him and be respectful, and this could be the opportunity of a lifetime." But Alvin couldn't bear Steinheim and reviled him constantly. "He's a fake. He's a bully. He's a cheapskate. He's a screamer. He's a shouter. He's a swindler. He's a man without a friend in the world. People cannot stand to be anywhere near him, and I," said Alvin, "have to chauffeur him around. He's cruel to his sons, is uninterested even in looking at a grandchild, and a skinny wife who never dares to say or do anything to displease him, he humiliates whenever the mood takes him. Everybody in the family has to live in apartments in the same luxury building that Abe built on a street of big oaks and maples near Uppsala College in East Orange. From dawn to dusk, the sons work for him in Newark, and he's screaming and yelling at them. Then at night, he's on the house phone with them in East Orange, and he's still screaming and yelling. Money is everything. Though not to buy things, but so as to be able to weather the storm, to protect his position and ensure his holdings and buy anything he wants in real estate at a discount, which is how he made a killing after the crash. Money, money, money. To be in the middle of the chaos and in the middle of the deals and make all the money in the world. Some guy retires at the age of 45 with $5 million. $5 million in the bank, which is as good as a zillion. And you know what Abe says? Alvin is asking this of my 12-year-old brother and me. Supper is over, and he's with us in the bedroom, all of us lying shoeless atop the covers, Sandy on his bed, Alvin on mine, and I beside Alvin, in the crook between his strong arm and his strong chest. And it's bliss. Stories about man's avarice, his zealousness, his unbounded vitality, and staggering arrogance. And to tell these stories, a cousin himself unbounded, even after all my father's work, a captivating cousin still emotionally among the rawest of the raw, who at 21 already has to shave his black stubble twice a day in order not to look like a hardened criminal. Stories of the carnivore descendants of the giant apes who once inhabited the ancient forests and have left the trees where all day long they nibbled on leaves to come to Newark and work downtown. "What does Mr. Steinheim say?" Sandy asked him. "He says, the guy has $5 million, that's all he has. Still young and in his prime with a chance someday to be worth 50, 60, maybe as much as $100 million. And he tells me, I'm taking it all off the table. I'm not you, Abe. I'm not hanging around for the heart attack. I have enough to call it a day and spend the rest of my life playing golf." And what does Abe say? "This is a man who is a total schmuck." Every subcontractor, when he comes into the office on Friday to collect money for the lumber, the glass, the brick, Abe says, "Look, we're out of money. This is the best I can do." And he pays them a half, a third. If he can get away with it, a quarter. And these people need the money to survive, but this is the method that Abe learned from his father. He's doing so much building that he gets away with it, and nobody tries to kill him. "Would somebody try to kill him?" Sandy asks. "Yeah," Alvin says. "Me." "Tell us about the wedding anniversary," I say. "The wedding anniversary," he repeats. "Yeah.
He sang 50 songs. He hires a piano player. Alvin tells us exactly the way he tells the tale of Abe at the piano every time I ask to hear it. And no one gets a word in. No one knows what is going on. All the guests spend the whole night eating his food, and he is standing in his tux by the piano, singing one song after another. And when they leave, he's still at the piano, still singing songs, every popular song you can think of, and he doesn't even listen when they say goodbye. "Does he scream and yell at you?" I ask Alvin. "At me? At everybody. He screams and yells wherever he goes. I drive him to Tabachnik's on Sunday mornings. The people are lined up to buy their bagels and lox. We walk in, and he's screaming. And there's a line of 600 people, but he's yelling, 'Abe is here!' And they move him to the front of the line. Tabachnik comes running out of the back. They push everyone aside, and Abe must order $5,000 worth of stuff. And we drive home, and there's Mrs. Steinheim, who weighs 92 pounds and knows when to get the hell out of the way. And he phones the three sons, and they're there in 5 seconds flat, and the four of them eat a meal for 400 people. The one thing he spends on is food. Food and cigars. You mentioned Tabachniks, Kartzmans. He doesn't care who is there, how many people. He gets there and buys out the whole store. They eat up every single slice of everything, every Sunday morning. Sturgeon, herring, sable, bagels, pickles. And then I drive him over to the renting office to see how many apartments are vacant, how many are rented, how many are being fixed up. 7 days a week, never stops. Never takes a vacation, no mañana. That's his slogan. It drives him crazy if anybody misses a minute of work. He cannot go to sleep without knowing that the next day there are more deals that will bring more money, and the whole damn thing makes me sick. The man to me is one thing only, a walking advertisement for the overthrow of capitalism. My father called Alvin's complaints kid stuff, and to be kept to himself on the job, especially after Abe decided that he was going to send Alvin to Rutgers. "You're too smart," Abe told Alvin, "to be so dumb." And then something happened beyond anything that my father could realistically have hoped for. Abe gets on the phone to the president of Rutgers and starts shouting at him. "You're going to take this boy. Where he finished in high school is not the issue. The boy is an orphan, potentially a genius. You're going to give him a full scholarship, and I'll build you a college building, the most beautiful in the world. But not so much as a shithouse goes up unless this orphan boy goes to Rutgers, all expenses paid." To Alvin, he explains, "I've never liked to have a formal chauffeur who was an idiot. I like kids like you, with something going for them. You're going to Rutgers, and you'll come home and drive me in the summers, and when you graduate Phi Beta Kappa, then the two of us sit down and talk." Abe would have had Alvin beginning as a freshman in New Brunswick in September 1941, and after 4 years of college, coming back as a somebody into the business. But instead, in February, Alvin left for Canada. My father was furious with him. They argued for weeks before finally, without telling us, Alvin took the express train from Newark Penn Station straight up to Montreal. "I don't get your morality, Uncle Herman. You don't want me to be a thief, but it's okay with you if I work for a thief?" Steinheim's not a thief. Steinheim's a builder. What he's doing is what they do, my father said. What they all have to do, because the building trade is a cutthroat business. But his buildings don't fall down, do they? Does he break the law, Alvin? Does he? No. He just screws the working man every chance he gets. I didn't know your morality was also for that. My morality stinks, said my father. Everybody in this city knows about my morality, but the issue isn't me. It's your future. It's going to college, a 4-year free college education. Free because he browbeats the president of Rutgers the way he browbeats the whole goddamn world. Let the president of Rutgers worry about that. What is the matter with you? You really want to sit there and tell me that the worst human being ever born is a man who wants to make you an educated person and find you a place in his building company? No. The worst human being ever born is Hitler. And frankly, I'd rather be fighting that son of a bitch than waste my time with a Jew like Steinheim, who only brings shame on the rest of us Jews by his goddamn... Oh, don't talk to me like a child. And the goddamns I can live without, too. The man doesn't bring shame on anyone. You think if you work for an Irish builder, it would be better? Try it.
Go work for Shanley. See what a lovely fellow he is. And the Italians? Would they be better, you think? Steinam shoots his mouth off. The Italians shoot guns.
And Longhi's Willman doesn't shoot guns?
Please, please. I know all about Longhi. I grew up on the same street with Longhi. What does any of this have to do with Rutgers?
It has to do with me, Uncle Herman, and being indebted to Steinheim for the rest of my life. Isn't it enough that he has three sons that he's already destroying? Isn't it enough that they have to attend every Jewish holiday with him and every Thanksgiving with him and every New Year's Eve with him? I have to be there to be shouted at too? All of them working in the same office and living in the same building and waiting around for only one thing, to split it all up on the day he dies. I can assure you, Uncle Herman, their grief won't last long.
You're wrong. You're dead wrong. There is more to these people than just money.
You're wrong. He holds them in his hand with the money. The man is totally berserk, and they stay, and they take it for fear of losing the money.
They stay because they're a family. All families go through a lot of families, both peace and war. We're going through a little war right now. I understand it. I accept it. But that's no reason to give up the college you missed out on, and that now you can have, and to run off half-cocked to fight Hitler instead.
So, said Alvin, as though at last he had the goods not only on his employer, but on his family protector as well. You're an isolationist, after all. You and Bengelsdorf. Bengelsdorf, Steinheim, they make a good couple.
Of what?
My father asked sourly, having finally run out of patience. Of Jewish fakes.
Oh, said my father.
Against the Jews now, too. Those Jews. The Jews who are a disgrace to the Jews, yes, absolutely.
The argument went on for four consecutive nights, and then on the fifth, a Friday, Alvin didn't report to eat, though the idea had been to keep him showing up regularly for dinner until my father wore him down and the boy came to his senses. The boy, whom my father had single-handedly changed from a callow good-for-nothing into the family's conscience. The next morning, we learned from Billy Steinheim, who was closest to Alvin of any of the sons and concerned enough about him to telephone us first thing Saturday, that after having received his Friday pay packet, Alvin had thrown the keys to the caddy in Billy's father's face and walked out. And when my father rushed off in our car to Wright Street to talk to Alvin in his room and get the whole story and gauge just how much damage he had done to his chances, the shoeshine parlor proprietor, who was Alvin's landlord, told him that the tenant had paid the rent and packed his things and was off to fight against the very worst human being ever born. Given the magnitude of Alvin's seething, no one less nefarious would do. The November election hadn't even been close. Lindbergh got 57% of the popular vote and, in an electoral sweep, carried 46 states, losing only FDR's home state of New York and by a mere 2,000 votes. Maryland, where the large population of federal office workers had voted overwhelmingly for Roosevelt, while the president was able to retain, as he could nowhere else below the Mason-Dixon line, the loyalty of nearly half the Democrats' old Southern constituency. Though on the morning after the election disbelief prevailed, especially among the pollsters, by the day after that, everybody seemed to understand everything. And the radio commentators and the news columnists made it sound as if Roosevelt's defeat had been preordained. What had happened, they explained, was that Americans had shown themselves unwilling to break the tradition of the two-term presidency that George Washington had instituted and that no president before Roosevelt had dared to challenge. Moreover, in the aftermath of the Depression, the resurgent confidence of young and old alike had been quickened by Lindbergh's relative youth and by the graceful athleticism that contrasted so starkly with the serious physical impediments under which FDR labored as a polio victim. And there was the wonder of aviation and the new way of life it promised. Lindbergh, already the record-breaking master of long-distance flight, could knowledgeably lead his countrymen into the unknown of the aeronautical future while assuring them, by his straight-laced, old-fashioned demeanor, that modern engineering achievements need not erode
the values of the past. It turned out, the experts concluded, that 20th century Americans, weary of confronting a new crisis in every decade, were starving for normalcy, and what Charles A. Lindbergh represented was normalcy raised to heroic proportions. A decent man with an honest face and an undistinguished voice who had resoundingly demonstrated to the entire planet the courage to take charge and the fortitude to shape history and, of course, the power to transcend personal tragedy. If Lindbergh promised no war, then there would be no war. For the great majority, it was as simple as that.
Even worse for us than the election were the weeks following the inauguration, when the new American president traveled to Iceland to meet personally with Adolf Hitler. And after 2 days of cordial talks, to sign an understanding guaranteeing peaceful relations between Germany and the United States.
There were demonstrations against the Iceland understanding in a dozen American cities, and impassioned speeches on the floor of the House and the Senate by Democratic congressmen who'd survived the Republican landslide, and who condemned Lindbergh for dealing with a murderous, fascist tyrant as his equal, and for accepting as their meeting place an island kingdom whose historic allegiance was to a democratic monarchy whose conquest the Nazis had already achieved. A national tragedy for Denmark, plainly deplorable to the people and their king, but one that Lindbergh's Reykjavik visit appeared tacitly to condone. When the president returned from Iceland to Washington, a flight formation of 10 large Navy patrol planes escorting the new two-engine Lockheed Interceptor that he himself piloted home, his address to the nation was a mere 5 sentences long. It is now guaranteed that this great country will take no part in the war in Europe. That was how the historic message began, and this is how it was elaborated and concluded. We will join no warring party anywhere on this globe. At the same time, we will continue to arm America and to train our young men in the armed forces in the use of the most advanced military technology. The key to our invulnerability is the development of American aviation, including rocket technology. This will make our continental borders unassailable to attack from without, while maintaining our strict neutrality. 10 days later, the president signed the Hawaii Understanding in Honolulu with Prince Fumimaro Konoye, Premier of the Japanese Imperial Government, and Foreign Minister Matsuoka. As emissaries of Emperor Hirohito, the two had already signed a triple alliance with the Germans and the Italians in Berlin in September of 1940, the Japanese endorsing the New Order in Europe, established under the leadership of Italy and Germany, who in turn endorsed the New Order in Greater East Asia, established by Japan. The three countries further pledged to support one another militarily should any of them be attacked by a nation not engaged in the European or Sino-Japanese War. Like the Iceland understanding, the Hawaii understanding made the United States a party in all but name to the Axis Triple Alliance by extending American recognition to Japan's sovereignty in East Asia and guaranteeing that the United States would not oppose Japanese expansion on the Asian continent, including annexation of the Netherlands Indies and French Indochina. Japan pledged to recognize U.S. sovereignty on its own continent, to respect the political independence of the American Commonwealth of the Philippines, scheduled to be enacted in 1946, and to accept the American territories of Hawaii, Guam, and Midway as permanent U.S. possessions in the Pacific. In the aftermath of the understandings, Americans everywhere went about declaiming, no war, no young men fighting and dying ever again. Lindbergh can deal with Hitler, they said. Hitler respects him because he's Lindbergh. Mussolini and Hirohito respect him because he's Lindbergh. The only ones against him, the people said, are the Jews. And certainly that was true in America. All the Jews could do was worry. Our elders on the street speculated incessantly about what they would do to us and whom we could rely on to protect us and how we might protect ourselves. The younger kids, like me, came home from school frightened and bewildered and even in tears because of what the older boys had been telling one another about what Lindbergh had said about us to Hitler and what Hitler had said about us to Lindbergh during their meals together in Iceland. One reason my parents decided to keep to our long-laid plans to visit Washington was to convince Sandy and me, whether or not they themselves believed it, that nothing had changed other than that FDR was no longer in office. America wasn't a fascist country and wasn't going to be, regardless of what Alvin had predicted. There was a new president and a new Congress, but each was bound to follow the law as set down in the Constitution. They were Republican, they were isolationist, and among them, yes, there were anti-Semites, as indeed there were among the Southerners in FDR's own party. But that was a long way from there being Nazis. Besides, one had only to listen on Sunday nights to Winchell lashing out at the new president and his friend Joe Goebbels, or hear him listing the sites under consideration by the Department of the Interior for building concentration camps, sites mainly located in Montana, the home state of Lindbergh's National Unity Vice President, the isolationist Democrat, Burton K. Wheeler, to be assured of the fervor with which the new administration was being scrutinized by favorite reporters of my father's, like Winchell and Dorothy Thompson and Quentin Reynolds and William L. Shirer, and, of course, by the staff of PM. Even I now took my turn with PM when my father brought it home at night, and not just to read the comic strip Barnaby or to flip through the pages of photographs, but to have in my hands documentary proof that, despite the incredible speed with which our status as Americans appeared to be altering, we were still living in a free country. After Lindbergh was sworn into office on January 20, 1941, FDR returned with his family to their estate at Hyde Park, New York, and hadn't been seen or heard from since. Because it was as a boy in the Hyde Park house that he had first become interested in collecting stamps, when his mother, as the story went, had passed on to him her own childhood albums, I imagined him there, spending all of his time arranging the hundreds of specimens that he had accumulated during his 8 years in the White House. As every collector knew, no president before him had ever commissioned his Postmaster General to issue so many new stamps. Nor had there been another American president so intimately involved with the Post Office Department. Practically, my first goal when I got my album was to accumulate all the stamps that I knew FDR had a hand in designing or that he'd personally suggested, beginning with the 1936 3-cent Susan B. Anthony stamp commemorating the 16th anniversary of the Woman Suffrage Amendment and the 1937 5-cent Virginia Dare stamp marking the birth at Roanoke 350 years earlier of the first English child born in America. The 1934 3-cent Mother's Day stamp, designed originally by FDR, and displaying in the left-hand corner the legend, "In memory and in honor of the mothers of America," and to the right of center, the artist Whistler's celebrated portrait of his mother, was given to me in a block of four by my own mother to help get my collection going. She also contributed to my purchasing the 7 commemorative stamps Roosevelt had approved in his first year as president, which I wanted because prominently displayed on 5 of them was 1933, the year I was born. Before we went to Washington, I asked permission to take my stamp album on the trip. Out of fear that I would lose it and be heartbroken afterward, my mother at first said no, but then allowed herself to be won over when I insisted on the necessity of at least having with me my president's stamps, the 16, that is, that I owned of the 1938 set that progressed sequentially and by denomination from George Washington to Calvin Coolidge, the 1922 Arlington National Cemetery stamp and the 1923 Lincoln Memorial and Capitol Building stamps were far too expensive for my budget. But I nonetheless offered as another reason for taking my collection along that the 3 famous sites were clearly pictured in black and white on the album page reserved for them. In fact, I was afraid to leave the album at home in our empty flat because of the nightmare I'd had. Afraid that either because I'd done nothing about removing the 10-cent Lindbergh airmail stamp from my collection, or because Sandy had lied to our parents and his Lindbergh drawings remained intact under his bed, or because of the one filial betrayal conspiring with the other, a malignant transformation would occur in my absence, causing my unguarded Washingtons to turn into Hitlers and swastikas to be imprinted on my national parks. Immediately upon entering Washington, we made a wrong turn in the heavy traffic, and while my mother was trying to read the road map and direct my father to our hotel, there appeared before us the biggest white thing I had ever seen. Atop an incline at the end of the street stood the U.S. Capitol, the broad stairs sweeping upward to the colonnade and capped by the elaborate three-tiered dome. Inadvertently, we had driven right to the very heart of American history. And whether we knew it in so many words, it was American history, delineated in its most inspirational form, that we were counting on to protect us against Lindbergh. "Look," my mother said, turning to Sandy and me in the back seat. "Isn't it thrilling?" The answer, of course, was yes. But Sandy appeared to have fallen into a patriotic stupor, and I took my cue from him and let silence register my awe as well. Just then, a motorcycle policeman pulled alongside us.
"What's up, Jersey?" he called through the open window. "We're looking for our hotel," answered my father.
"What's it called, Bess?"
My mother, enthralled only a moment earlier by the dwarfing majesty of the Capitol, immediately went pale, and her voice was so feeble when she tried to speak that she couldn't be heard above the traffic.
"Gotta get your folks out of here," the cop shouted. "Speak up, Mrs.
The Douglas Hotel."
It was my brother eagerly calling out to him and trying to get a good look at the motorcycle.
"On K Street, officer."
"Attaboy."
And he raised his arm in the air, signaling the cars behind us to stop and for ours to follow him as he made a U-turn and started in the opposite direction up Pennsylvania Avenue. Laughing, my father said,
"We're getting the royal treatment."
"But how do you know where he's taking us?" my mother asked.
"Herman, what's happening?"
With the cop out front, we were headed past one big federal building after another when Sandy excitedly pointed toward a rolling lawn just to our left.
"Up there," he shouted. "The White House!"
Whereupon my mother began to cry. "It isn't," she tried to explain just before we reached the hotel and the cop waved goodbye and roared away. "It isn't like living in a normal country anymore. I'm terribly sorry, children. Please forgive me." But then she began to cry again. In a little room at the rear of the Douglas, there was a double bed for my parents and cots for my brother and me, and no sooner had my father tipped the bellhop, who'd unlocked our door and set our bags down inside the room, than our mother was her old self, or pretended as much, by arranging the contents of our suitcases in the dresser and noting appreciatively that the drawers were freshly laid with lining paper. We'd been on the road since leaving home at 4 in the morning, and it was after 1 in the afternoon when we got back down to the street to look for a place to have lunch. The car was parked across from the hotel, and standing beside it was a sharp-faced little man in a double-breasted gray suit who doffed his hat and said, "My name is Taylor, folks. I'm a professional guide to the nation's capital. If you don't want to be wasting time, you might want to hire someone like me. I'll drive for you so you don't get lost. I'll take you to the sights, tell you all there is to know. I'll wait and pick you up. I'll make sure you eat where the price is right and the food is tasty, and all it will cost, using your own automobile, is $9 a day. Here's my authorization," he said. And he unfolded a document of several pages to show to my father. "Issued by the Chamber of Commerce," he explained. "Verlin M. Taylor, sir. Official D.C. guide since 1937. January 5th, 1937, to be exact. The very day the 75th U.S. Congress convened." The two shook hands, and in his insurance man's best businesslike manner,
My father flipped through the guide's papers before handing them back to him.
Looks good to me, my father said, but I don't think $9 a day is in the cards, Mr. Taylor. Not for this family, anyway.
I appreciate that. But on your own, sir, you doing the driving and not knowing your way around and then trying to find a parking space in this city, well, you and the family won't see a half of what you'll be able to see with me, and you won't enjoy it anywhere near as much either. Why, I could drive you to a nice place to have your lunch, wait for you with the car, and then we can start right off with the Washington Monument. After that, down the mall to the Lincoln Memorial. Washington and Lincoln. Our two greatest presidents. That's how I always like to begin. You know that Washington never did live in Washington? President Washington chose the site. He signed the bill making it the permanent seat of the government, but it was his successor, John Adams, who was the first president to move into the White House in 1800. November 1st, to be exact, his wife, Abigail, joined him there 2 weeks later. Among the many interesting curios in the White House, there was still a celery glass owned by John and Abigail Adams.
Well, that's something I did not know, my father replied.
But let me take this up with my wife. Quietly, he asked her,
can we afford this? He sure knows his oats.
Our mother whispered,
but who sent him? How did he spot our car? That's his job, Bess. To find who's the tourist. That's how the man makes a living.
My brother and I were huddled up beside them, hoping our mother would shut up and that the easy-talking guide with the pointy face and the short legs would be hired for the duration.
What do you want? My father said, turning to Sandy and me.
Well, if it costs too much, Sandy began.
Forget the cost, my father replied. Do you like this guy or not?
He's a character, Dad, Sandy whispered. He looks like one of those duck decoys. I like when he says, to be exact.
Bess, my father said, the man is a bona fide guide to Washington, D.C. Don't believe he's ever cracked a smile, but he's an alert little guy and he couldn't be more polite. Let me see if he'll take $7.
Here, he stepped away from us, walked up to the guide. They spoke seriously for a few minutes and then the deal struck. The two again shook hands and my father said aloud,
okay, let's eat.
As always, teeming with energy even when there was nothing to do. It was hard to say what was most unbelievable. My being out of New Jersey for the first time in my life, my being 300 miles from home in the nation's capital, or our families being chauffeured in our own automobile by a stranger called by the same surname as the 12th President of the United States, whose profile adorned the 12-cent red violet stamp in the album in my lap, hinged between the blue 11-cent poke and the green 13-cent Fillmore.
Washington, Mr. Taylor was telling us, is divided into four sections, northwest, northeast, southeast, and southwest. With some few exceptions, the streets running north and south are numbered, and the streets running east and west are lettered. Of all the existing capitals in the Western world, this city alone was developed solely to provide a home for the national government. That is what makes it different not only from London and Paris, but from our own New York and Chicago.
Did you hear that? My father asked, looking over his shoulder at Sandy and me. Did you hear that, Bess? What Mr. Taylor said about why Washington is so special?
Yes, she said, and took my hand in hers to assure herself by assuring me that everything was now going to be all right. But I had only my one concern from the time we entered Washington until we left, preserving my stamp collection from harm. The cafeteria where Mr. Taylor dropped us off was clean and cheap and the food as good as he said it would be. And when we finished our meal and headed for the street, there was our car pulling up to double park out front.
What timing, my father cried.
Over the years, Mr. Taylor said, you learn to estimate how long it takes a family to eat their lunch.
Was that okay, Mrs. Roth? He asked our mother. Everything to your taste?
Very nice. Thank you.
So's everybody ready for the Washington Monument, he said.
And off we drove.
You know, of course, who the monument commemorates. Our first president, and in the opinion of most, our best president, alongside President Lincoln. I'd include FDR in that list, you know. a great man, and the people of this country turned him out of office, my father said. And just look what we got instead.
Mr. Taylor listened courteously, but offered no response.
Now, he resumed, you've all seen photos of the Washington Monument, but they don't always communicate just how impressive it is. At 555 feet, 5 1/8 inches above ground, it is the tallest masonry structure in the world. The new electric elevator will carry you to the top in 1 1/4 minutes. Otherwise, you can take a winding staircase of 893 steps to the top by foot. The view from up there has a radius of some 15 to 20 miles. It's worth a look. There, see it? He said, straight ahead.
Minutes later, Mr. Taylor found a parking spot on the monument grounds, and when we left the car, trotted bandy-legged alongside us, explaining, the monument was cleaned just a few years back for the first time.
Just imagine that for a cleaning job, Mrs. Roth. They used water mixed with sand and steel bristle brushes. Took 5 months and cost $100,000.
Under FDR, my father asked.
I believe so, yes.
And do people know? My father asked. Do people care?
No. They want an airmail pilot running the country instead, and that's not the worst of it.
Mr. Taylor remained outside while we entered the monument. At the elevator, our mother, who again had taken hold of my hand, drew close to our father and whispered,
you mustn't talk like that.
Like what?
About Lindbergh.
That? That's just expressing my opinion.
But you don't know who this man is.
I sure do. He's an authorized guide with the documents to prove it. This is the Washington Monument, Bess, and you're telling me to keep my thoughts to myself as though the Washington Monument is situated in Berlin?
His speaking so bluntly distressed her even more, especially as the others waiting for the elevator could overhear our conversation. Turning to another of the fathers, who was standing alongside his wife and two kids, my father asked him,
where are you folks from?
We're from Jersey.
Maine, the man replied.
Hear that?
My father said to my brother and me. Altogether, some 20 children and adults entered the elevator, filling it up about halfway, and as the car rose through the housing of iron pillars, my father used the 1 1/4 minutes it took to get to the top to ask the remaining families where each was from.
Mr. Taylor was waiting outside when we finished our tour. He asked Sandy and me to describe what we'd seen from the windows 500 feet up, and then he guided us on a quick walking tour around the exterior of the monument, recounting the fitful history of its construction. Next, he took some pictures of the family with our Brownie box camera. Then my father, over Mr. Taylor's objections, insisted on taking a picture of him with my mother, Sandy, and me with the Washington Monument as the background. And finally, we got into our car and, with Mr. Taylor again at the wheel, started down the mall for the Lincoln Memorial. This time, while he parked, Mr. Taylor warned us that the Lincoln Memorial was like no other edifice anywhere in the world and that we should prepare ourselves to be overwhelmed. Then he accompanied us from the parking area to the great pillared building with the wide marble stairs that led us up past the columns to the hall's interior and the raised statue of Lincoln in his capacious throne of thrones, the sculpted face looking to me like the most hallowed possible amalgamation, the face of God and the face of America, all in one. Gravely, my father said, and they shot him, the dirty dogs. The four of us stood directly at the base of the statue, which was lit, so as to make everything about Abraham Lincoln seem colossally grand. What ordinarily passed for great just paled away, and there was no defense for either an adult or a child against the solemn atmosphere of hyperbole.
When you think of what this country does to its greatest presidents, Herman, my mother pleaded, don't start.
I'm not starting anything. This was a great tragedy. Isn't that right, boys? The assassination of Lincoln.
Mr. Taylor came over and quietly told us, tomorrow we'll go to Ford's Theater, where he was shot, and across the street to the Peterson House to see where he died.
I was saying, Mr. Taylor, it is the damnedest thing what this country does to its great men.
Thank goodness we have President Lindbergh, said the voice of a woman just a few feet away.
She was elderly and she was standing apart by herself, consulting a guidebook, and her remark seemed spoken to no one, and yet prompted somehow by her overhearing my father.
Compare Lincoln to Lindbergh. Boy, oh boy, my father moaned.
In fact, the elderly lady was not alone, but with a group of tourists, among whom was a man of about my father's age who might have been her son.
Something bothering you? He asked my father, assertively stepping in our direction.
Not me, my father told him.
Something bothering you about what the lady just said? No, sir. Free country.
The stranger took a long, gaping look at my father, then my mother, then Sandy, and then me.
And what did he see?
A trim, neatly muscled, broad-chested man, 5'9" tall, handsome in a minor key, with soft grayish-green eyes and thinning brown hair clipped close at the temples and presenting his two ears to the world a little more comically than was necessary. The woman was slender but strong, and she was tidily dressed, with a lock of her wavy dark hair over one eyebrow and roundish cheeks a little rouged and a prominent nose and chunky arms and shapely legs and slim hips and the lively eyes of a girl half her age. In both adults, a surfeit of prudence and a surfeit of energy. And with the couple, two boys still pretty much all soft surfaces, young children of youthful parents, keenly attentive and in good health, and incorrigible only in their optimism. And the conclusion the stranger drew from his observations, he demonstrated with a mocking movement of the head. Then, hissing noisily so as to mislead no one about his assessment of us, he returned to the elderly lady and their sightseeing party, walking slowly off with a rolling gait that seemed, along with the silhouette of his broad back, intended to register a warning. It was from there that we heard him refer to my father as a loud-mouth Jew, followed a moment later by the elderly lady declaring, "I'd give anything to slap his face." Mr. Taylor led us quickly away to a smaller hall just off the main chamber, where there was a tablet inscribed with the Gettysburg Address and a mural whose theme was the Emancipation.
"To hear words like that in a place like this," said my father, his choked voice quivering with indignation,
"in a shrine to a man like this."
Meanwhile, Mr. Taylor, pointing to the painting, said, "See there? An angel of truth is freeing a slave." But my father could see nothing.
"You think you'd hear that here if Roosevelt was president? People wouldn't dare. They wouldn't dream. In Roosevelt's day..."
My father said,
"But now that our great ally is Adolf Hitler, now that the best friend of the President of the United States is Adolf Hitler, why, now they think they can get away with anything. Disgraceful. Starts with the White House."
Whom was he talking to, other than me? My brother was trailing after Mr. Taylor, asking about the mural, and my mother was trying to prevent herself from saying or doing anything, struggling against the very emotions that had overpowered her earlier in the car. And back then, without anything like this much justification.
"Read that," my father said, alluding to the tablet bearing the Gettysburg Address. "Just read it. All men are created equal."
"Herman," gasped my mother, "I can't go on with this." We came back out into the daylight and gathered together on the top step. The tall shaft of the Washington Monument was a half mile away, at the other end of the reflecting pool that lay at the base of the terraced approach to the Lincoln Memorial. There were elm trees planted all around. It was the most beautiful panorama I'd ever seen. A patriotic paradise, the American Garden of Eden, spread before us, and we stood huddled together there, the family expelled.
"Listen," my father said, pulling my brother and me close to him, "I think it's time we all had a nap. It's been a long day for everybody. I say we go back to the hotel and get some rest for an hour or two. What do you say, Mr. Taylor?"
"Up to you, Mr. Roth." After supper, I thought the family might enjoy a tour in the car of Washington by night, with the famous monuments all lit up.
"Now you're talking," my father told him.
"Sound good, Bess?"
But my mother wasn't so easy to cheer up as Sandy and I.
"Honey," my father told her, "we ran into a screwball, two screwballs. We might have gone up to Canada and run into somebody just as bad. We're not going to let that ruin our trip. Let's have a nice rest, all of us, and Mr. Taylor will wait for us, and we'll go on from there.
Look, he then said with a sweep of his outstretched arm. This is something every American should see. Turn around, boys. Take one last look at Abraham Lincoln.
We did as he instructed, but it was impossible any longer to feel the raptures of patriotism turning me inside out. As we began the long descent down the marble staircase, I heard some kids behind us asking their parents, "Is that really him? Is he buried there under all that stuff?" My mother was directly beside me on the stairs, trying to act like someone whose panic wasn't running wild within her. And suddenly, I felt that it had fallen to me to hold her together, to become all at once a courageous new creature with something of Lincoln himself clinging to him. But all I could do when she offered me a hand was to take it and clutch it like the unripened being I was, a boy whose stamp collection still represented 9/10 of his knowledge of the world. In the car, Mr. Taylor plotted the rest of our day. We'd go back to the hotel, nap, and at 5:45, he'd come to pick us up and drive us to dinner. We could return to the cafeteria near Union Station where we'd had our lunch, or he could recommend a couple of other popular-priced restaurants whose quality he could vouch for. And after dinner, he'd take us on the tour of Washington by night.
"Nothing phases you, does it, Mr. Taylor?" my father said.
He replied only with a noncommittal nod.
"Where are you from?" my father asked him.
"Indiana, Mr. Roth."
"Indiana. Imagine that, boys. And what's your hometown out there?" my father asked him.
"Didn't have one. My father's a mechanic, fixed farm machinery, moved all the time." "Well," said my father, for reasons that can't have been too clear to Mr. Taylor, "I take my hat off to you, sir. You should be proud of yourself." Again, Mr. Taylor gave only a nod. He was a no-nonsense man in a tight suit and with something decidedly military about his efficiency and his bearing, like a hidden person, except there was nothing to hide, everything impersonal about him being plainly visible. Voluble, talking about Washington, D.C., closed-mouthed about everything else. When we got back to the hotel, Mr. Taylor parked the car and accompanied us in as though he were not just our guide, but our chaperone. And a good thing it was, because inside the lobby of the small hotel, we discovered our 4 suitcases standing beside the front desk. The new man at the desk introduced himself as the manager. When my father asked what our bags were doing downstairs, the manager said,
"Folks, I have to apologize. Had to pack these up for you. Our afternoon clerk made a mistake. The room he gave you was being held for another family. Here's your deposit."
And he handed my father an envelope containing a $10 bill.
"But my wife wrote you people. You wrote us back. We had a reservation months ago. That's why we sent the deposit. Bess, where's the copies of the letters?"
She pointed to the bags.
"Sir," said the manager, "the room is occupied and there are no vacancies. We will not charge you for what use you all made of the room today or for the bar of soap that is missing."
Missing? Just the word to send him right off the rails. "Are you saying we stole it?"
"No, sir, I am not. Perhaps one of the children took the soap as a souvenir. No harm done. We're not going to haggle about something so small or start looking through their pockets for the soap."
"What is the meaning of this?"
my father demanded to know, and under the manager's nose pounded his fist on the front desk. "Mr. Roth, if you're going to make a scene here..."
"Yes," my father said, "I am going to make a scene till I find out what's up with that room."
"Well then," replied the manager, "I have no choice but to phone the police." Here, my mother, who was holding my brother and me around the shoulders, shielding us alongside her and at a safe distance from the desk, called my father's name, trying to prevent him from going further. But it was too late for that. It always had been. Never could he have consented to quietly occupying the place that the manager wished to assign him.
"This is that goddamn Lindbergh," my father said. "All you little fascists are in the saddle now."
"Shall I call the district police, sir, or will you take your bags and your family and leave immediately?"
"Call the police," my father replied. "You do that."
There were now 5 or 6 guests aside from us in the lobby. They entered while the argument was underway, and they were lingering to find out what was going to come of it. It was then that Mr. Taylor stepped up to my father's side and said, "Mr. Roth, you are perfectly in the right, but the police are the wrong solution.
No, that is the right solution. Call the police, my father repeated to the manager. There are laws in this country against people like you.
The manager reached for the phone, and while he dialed, Mr. Taylor went over to our bags, swept up two in either hand, and carried them out of the hotel. My mother said, Herman, it's over. Mr. Taylor took the bags.
No, Bess, he said bitterly. I've had enough of their guff. I want to talk to the police.
Mr. Taylor re-entered the lobby on the run and without stopping bore down on the desk where the manager was completing his call. In a lowered voice, he spoke only to my father. There's a nice hotel not very far away. I telephoned them from the booth outside. They have a room for you. It's a nice hotel on a nice street. Let's drive over there and get the family registered.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. But right now, we are waiting for the police. I want them to remind this man of the words in the Gettysburg Address that I read carved up there just today.